Under the metrics of the war game, the fictional 46th President of the United States, an unconventional politician whose presidency is buffeted by a seemingly endless string of crises, commits the United States to a massive military response directed against Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM in Mauritania. This fictional president is as much a stand-in for America's current bombing president, Joe Biden, as it was for the tumultuous former president, Donald Trump. In the war game from 2017, the U.S. president promises resolve and a well-planned short conflict meant to decimate AQIM. Instead, just as with Afghanistan, Iraq, and countless other counterinsurgency wars, the Americans get bogged down for years after the initial invasion in 2023. Just as U.S. servicemen and women experienced in Iraq and Afghanistan, the fighting with Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM, is not constrained to the national boundaries of Mauritania. It transcends that nation and encompasses the neighboring countries of Mali and Algeria. And just as Iraq in 2003 became a magnet attracting the extremist militants from the so-called Greater Middle East, the U.S.-led fight against Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM, attracts militants from around the world. The U.S.-led coalition in Mauritania eventually becomes stymied by the transnational nature of the war, just as the real-world coalitions were in both Afghanistan and Iraq. The destructive pattern of those two failed wars repeat again when, in 2025, the Americans try to hand off the war to the locals, in this case the African Union, and it goes as disastrously wrong as the other wars did. The longer the war drags on with the US and allied forces directly involved, the more diffuse the terrorist threat becomes. Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM's success against the Americans, reinvigorates Boko Haram, just as American intervention in Iraq propagated Daesh terrorists, al-Nusra terrorists, and a host of other Takfiri terror groups throughout the wider region. The war is inconclusive, and by 2026, U.S. allies are withdrawing, and Washington is yet again at a terrible crossroads. Does it double down on failure and ensure the endless war, this time in West Africa, drags on for decades longer? Or does it suffer another humiliating defeat at the hands of extremist militants? Don't you think this is on America's plate after Afghanistan? Just look at the last few months of the Biden administration. Over the summer, President Biden ordered the largest strike against militants of Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Further, as he was rightly taking flak for this horrific evacuation plan in Afghanistan, Joe Biden took to the airwaves to insist that the real fight in the so-called global war on terror was no longer in Afghanistan and West Asia. Instead, Biden argued, the center of gravity in the war has now shifted to Africa. Beyond that, the Biden administration's shadow president, Susan Rice, cut her teeth in Africa policy. The region has been an area of great concern for Susan Rice for years. What's more, over the past decade, the U.S. foreign policy establishment has been concerned by the growth of Chinese power and influence in the African continent. More recently, the head of U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM, has fretted over the rise of Russian groups throughout Africa. Washington has become awash with experts insisting that the U.S. is losing Africa to its rivals, and the presence of Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM, and other extremist militant groups provides the perfect pretext for expanding America's military footprint there, especially as the graybeards in Washington seek to shift the narrative from Afghanistan. While the threat of extremist militants in Africa is indeed growing, and both Chinese and Russian influence in Africa relative to that of the United States is troubling, Joe Biden and his team must avoid the siren song of military intervention in Africa. Although the fact that the U.S. security state has been preparing for an Afghanistan in West Africa with the presence of Africa hawks like Susan Rice being nestled inside the Biden administration, it is more than likely that soon the United States will be as committed to nation-building in West Africa as it was in both Afghanistan and Iraq, with similarly disastrous consequences. The U.S. desperately needs new leadership before it bleeds another generation in an endless war.
From New York to Kabul.
Part 2.
In 2010, the New York Times hinted at the collaboration between the U.S. Geological Survey and the Pentagon. The collaboration was to estimate the value of the mines in Afghanistan by using samples. This is the most prominent figure in the Pentagon, who was the commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East until 2010. General David Petraeus. As the highest-ranking U.S. military commander in Afghanistan, he had this to say about mines in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan is blessed with the presence of what are trillions, with an S on the end, trillions of dollars worth of minerals, if and only if you can get the extractive technology, the human capital operated, the lines of communication to enable you to get it out of the country and all the rest of that. Very big if, and of course there's a foundation of security that would be necessary on which to build all of that. But again, the prospects are very significant if you can achieve objectives.
There are many estimates about the value of mines in Afghanistan, from $1 to $3 trillion to dozens of trillions of dollars.
There's a figure floating out there that it's actually $3 trillion, and I've heard a figure of $30 trillion.
In 1998, Congress published a report on the vitality of mineral resources in Central Asian countries for the U.S. At the same time, the U.S.'s main problem was to transfer the oil and gas to the market. The U.S.'s ideal was to construct a pipeline in Afghanistan and transfer it to Pakistan and India to get access to high seas. India's Outlook News Agency says Bush's main goal by attacking Afghanistan was pipeline politics. But after a while, with more investigation, it came to light that besides international transit, Afghanistan has some mines that are worth more than the mines anywhere else in Central Asia. Uranium, a strategic stone with vast resources in Afghanistan's Helmand province, where the U.S. and British troops were stationed in large numbers. Chromite industrial stone can be found in Khost and Logar provinces. Marble can be found in various parts of Afghanistan in large deposits, and dozens of other types of precious stones in Afghanistan. The bluest stone in the world is Badakhshan's azure. Emerald in Panjshir, gold in Badakhshan, tourmaline in Kunar, chondrodite, quartz and various types of topaz, prosylite, aquamarine, and agate. After uranium, the next strategic mineral that Afghanistan has the biggest deposits in the world is copper. In our era, copper is more valuable because it has a basic role in renewable technologies like wind turbines and solar panels.
As the world electrifies, and whether it's moving towards green energy, whether it's solar or wind, what does that require? An enormous amount of copper. when you have every megawatt of wind power installed requires 7 tons of copper.
Since Eric Prince is involved in renewable energy's business, he knows well how vital the copper mines in Afghanistan are.
And if you build a mine, right, there's a place like Mas Ainak. It's 50 kilometers south of Kabul. It's the largest copper deposit in the world, more than 6 million tons of copper. Do it manually. I'll employ 10,000 Afghans with picks and shovels and pay them $12 a day. The Taliban's paying 10, we pay 12. I take great umbrage when people say, Eric Prince wants to privatize this and make money. Yeah, I'm going to make I would try to make money.
Talc. The name of the mineral might not sound familiar to many people. The white material can be found in abundance in Afghanistan. Besides the wrong methods of extraction that can irreversibly damage the mines, the bitter reality is, based on a report by Global Witness in 2018, a large part of the talc mines in Afghanistan are in the hands of Daesh. The militant group has been mercilessly extracting and exporting talc and has achieved considerable financial resources. But where does the huge amount of talc is exported to? Global Witness published a report in 2016. Based on the report, almost all of the talc in Afghanistan goes to the U.S. and European countries via Pakistan. So the United States can indirectly benefit from the Daesh presence in Afghanistan because it can easily get inexpensive smuggled talc without having to foot any security bill. So it's easy to guess why the U.S. isn't serious about uprooting Daesh in Afghanistan. Talc is an important material for many industries, the plastic industry, paint industries, and ceramics. Talc is the main element in baby powder. The famous U.S. brand Johnson & Johnson is one of the biggest consumers of talc in the world. Peter Frankopan, British writer and researcher, explicitly tells us about the relationship between the talc used in baby powder and Daesh.
The relationship between baby powder and global world power. Can you expand on that sort of dilemma a little bit?
Talcum powder is the softest powder known to mankind, right? And it's found, like lapis and like gold, almost exclusively in Afghanistan. And ISIS-K, which is sort of the Central Asian variant of ISIS-Daesh. So ISIS-K have been very effective in trying to work out what assets produce cash. And one of the things they've targeted are the talcum mines in Afghanistan. And that brings them estimates around about, Global Witness did the work on this, somewhere between $20 and $30 million a year minimum. And that's quite a lot of cash. That powder has come from probably ISIS-controlled territory, shipped out through Pakistan, through legal or illegal.
Dasht-e-Nawar Desert Plateau in the Ghazni province. At the heart of the desert, there exists one of the most special needs of human beings today, lithium. Many people call it the oil of the 21st century.
Lithium in Afghanistan. So certainly the lithium deposits are not that common. These are salts that rapidly erode into the ocean. So finding them in on land is difficult. With the rise in the electronics industry, the need for lithium is only going to increase. And so you can imagine these are worth quite a bit of money.
Any electronic gadget that is charged and anything that has a battery needs lithium. The expansion of electric vehicles is something that has increased our need for lithium severalfold. Eric Prince's engagement in the field of electric vehicles can be another reason behind his attachment to the mines in Afghanistan.
Working on a fund, a bigger investment fund, to do some of the strategic minerals that you need to make electric vehicles, right? There's a big shift coming in electric vehicles. Electric vehicles are coming.
The vast resources of lithium deposits in Afghanistan led to the realization of a prediction. Afghanistan became Saudi Arabia of lithium.
And the New York Times described it very, very well, calling Afghanistan the lithium country, the Saudi Arabia of lithium. So where Saudi Arabia is the oil capital of the world, Afghanistan will be the lithium capital of the world.
Jess Ventura, he was the governor of Minnesota from 1999 to 2003. He was an influential politician in most U.S. administrations and one of Donald Trump's old friends. In recent years, his revelations about the United States political system have caused controversies.
By the way, I now know why we're in Afghanistan.
Why is that?
A month ago, they announced it's got the biggest lithium deposit in the world.
For batteries?
Sure. Every cell phone, every computer, everything runs off of lithium. Cars are going to run off it. And we're still buying that we're there to fight terrorism and the Taliban? Give me a break. It's a red herring. The whole war on terror is just a red herring to get what they want to do. It's the lithium. What do you think we're there? Iraq's the oil.
The Technology Analysis Institute, VentureBeat, has a strange analysis. The future of Silicon Valley might become dependent on Afghan mountains. Silicon Valley is a region in southeast San Francisco, in California. It's considered the United States technology capital. This is the place where dozens of big companies like Tesla vitally need lithium.
Basically, extract the lithium from the ore.
In line with his strategy to get back the money spent in Afghanistan, Trump forced one of the world's biggest mining investors in the U.S. to go to Afghanistan. As the Wall Street Journal says, Trump push yielded copper and gold deals in Afghanistan. But who's the investor? He was one of the former CEOs of the American bank, J.P. Morgan.
J.P. Morgan
is right now the biggest bank in the United States, probably the history of the United States. Right now, they're also the biggest bank in the world by market capitalization.
He's a banker and a mysterious character. There's no public or official interview with him. He's nicknamed the King of Mining. He's a British investor named Ian Hannam. He went to Afghanistan for the first time several years ago. In 2011, he established a series of chain companies for Afghanistan. The companies were mostly for research and experimental purposes. For several years, they extracted samples and studied the mines in Afghanistan. But after the years-long assessment based on the samples, there were rumors that the West was about to sign the biggest mining contract in Afghanistan. Badakhshan's gold and Balkhab's copper, with the prospect of creating 13,000 job opportunities and its $1 billion effect on the Afghan economy. But the contract was secretly signed in an unconventional way in Afghanistan's embassy in Washington. Ian Hannam was also present in the embassy, along with some Afghan political figures. The unconventionality of the contract led to rumors from the start. The New York Times reported there were legal concerns over the deal. Despite the ifs and buts, later on it was proved that the deal was just a cover. A year later, the contract was revoked. Politicization of the issue was one of the reasons mentioned for canceling the contract. Systematic corruption within the Afghan political structure and its dependence on foreign powers could be one of the most important reasons. But the more important question is, why Hannam didn't make a transparent investment in Afghanistan and only took samples and did experimental tests for assessment. The only thing that comes to mind regarding the issue is Eric Prince's close contact with Ian Hannam. Their relationship was clearly seen in natural resources and security issues in Venezuela. Ian Hannam canceled the copper contract in Balkhab and the gold contract in Badakhshan, under circumstances that Eric Prince had launched his own project to privatize the war and mines in Afghanistan. Ian Hanham's documents and samples of the mines could give Eric Prince the best classified information so he could start his mining activities in Afghanistan. It's only natural that Afghanistan needs foreign investment in its mining sector, but it become unnatural when it's handed over to the political mafia and foreign figures.
Well, there's no doubt that since the U.S. invaded in October 2001, the war has been partly privatized, and the effect of that on civilian lives has been devastating. However, what Eric Prince is trying to do here is even worse. What he's trying to do is two things. One, privatize the war. He claims that thousands of private mercenaries can essentially do what the U.S. military has not been able to do in 17 years of war. Prince has plans to try to exploit the country's resources. He has the Trump administration behind. He wants to try to exploit lithium and gold and rare earths in a diluted plan to be able to somehow profit, obviously, for his own company. It would worsen violence, not make it any better.
And in fact, as long as war and military occupation continue in Afghanistan, nothing will get better. Killing Afghan people by the U.S. forces turned into something ordinary. It makes news headlines every now and then. More than 102,000 Afghan civilians lost their lives from 2009 to 2019. During the 20-year occupation by the U.S. from 2001 to 2021, over 150,000 people in Afghanistan were killed. A considerable part of the crimes was committed by U.S. airstrikes. From 2007 to 2019, the U.S. dropped 20 bombs on the Afghan people every day on average. In 2019 only, it conducted 7,423 airstrikes on the country.
It looked like nothing was happening. Indeed, it looked like we were in a, altogether now, quagmire.
Sir, I was going
to
say stalemate.
Stalemate, yes.
These are familiar words, a stalemate from the past.
If you take a look at Afghanistan.
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 The United States of America is a friend to the Afghan people.
And end the war in Afghanistan.
Get out of Afghanistan.
And today.
My name's Joe Biden. I'm a Democrat.
What did you know?
Afghanistan, you said?
Yes, sir. Afghanistan.
That's interesting.
In a symbolic move, exactly in the room that Bush issued the order to attack, Joe Biden announced that U.S. military forces will completely withdraw from Afghanistan in 2021.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility on to a fifth. The United States will begin our final withdrawal, begin it on May 1 of this year.
It is not clear, or maybe it is not important anymore, if he, just like his predecessors, says something in interviews and does something else in reality. The important thing is Afghanistan, which is riddled with so many questions. Definitely, any major development starts with asking questions. The questions arise from the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. Will we witness a different kind of U.S. presence in Afghanistan after it pulls out of the country and vacates the military bases? What should we expect if the speculations about the private security contractors going to Afghanistan are true? The people in Afghanistan have paid the most for the war. Will there be an end to their endless sufferings after the U.S. withdrawal? After 20 years of the Western country's military presence, it doesn't come as a surprise that Afghanistan is the saddest country in the world, according to the UN report in 2021. Will Afghanistan experience life differently, or will the vicious circle repeat? Only time will tell.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Ida is barreling through Louisiana, making landfall in the state as a powerful Category 4 hurricane on Sunday afternoon, 29th of August. It was one of the strongest hurricanes on record by both wind speed and pressure to roar ashore in Louisiana. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Oliver Lachlan and Richard Luscombe under the heading Hurricane Ida. Up to 2 million without power as New Orleans assesses damage. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. After 2 million people remained without power in and around New Orleans on Monday, 30th of August, as residents and authorities began to assess catastrophic damage from Hurricane Ida, a 150-mile-per-hour monster storm that was the most powerful ever to hit Louisiana. At least one person was known to have been killed by a falling tree. The state's governor, John Bel Edwards, and President Joe Biden said they expected the death toll to rise. Crews using airboats and helicopters were conducting search and rescue missions in several neighborhoods, seeking people stranded in the attics or on roofs of flooded homes. Almost 5,000 National Guard troops were activated, a number Edwards said would double by Tuesday, 31st of August. Residents woke to widespread devastation caused by the Category 4 hurricane that made landfall on Sunday, 29th of August, at Port Fourchon. Then tore a path north towards New Orleans. The storm struck the city of New Orleans on the 16th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, which killed more than 1,800 individuals, mostly by flooding. Roofs torn from buildings, fallen trees, utility poles, and other storm debris blocked roads and hampered rescue efforts. Downed power lines, many still live, created a dangerous situation for those emerging to assess the damage. Edwards said at an afternoon briefing held by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, he said Hurricane Ida came onshore with everything that was advertised, the surge, the rain, the wind, adding, the damage is catastrophic, primarily wind-driven, but we know that there were some areas that received tremendous rainfall as well. He added that his best guess was that 2 million people were without electricity. Earlier, he said, dozens of U.S. Coast Guard helicopters and high-water vehicles had been deployed. Edwards added, "We know that individuals are out there waiting to be rescued because their homes are not habitable, and in many places we have floodwaters that are encroaching upon those homes." U.S. President Joe Biden, who signed the federal disaster declaration on Sunday, 29th of August, promised government resources to back up state and local rescue efforts and recovery efforts. He said, "We knew Hurricane Ida had the potential to cause massive, massive damage, and that's exactly what we saw. We have at least one confirmed death. That's a number which is likely to grow." By mid-morning, Hurricane Ida was downgraded to a tropical storm, but it was still expected to deliver life-threatening flooding and damaging winds as it moved north and west through Mississippi and the Tennessee Valley. Many residents of New Orleans, which was totally blacked out after a key electricity transmission tower fell into the Mississippi River, heeded warnings to evacuate. Those who left were told to stay away until further notice. In the historic French Quarter of New Orleans, streets were lined with storm detritus. Fallen trees, roofing bricks, and wrought iron railings severed from balconies above. The sound of barking dogs and the buzzing of generators echoed down usually busy streets, now empty and near silent. With little indication of when electricity would be restored, many looked to get out of the city. As one resident walked down Royal Street examining the damage, she turned to her husband and said, "Mother Nature has its day." The National Hurricane Center said Ida tied with last year's Hurricane Laura and an unnamed hurricane in 1856 as the strongest to hit the state. According to a report from New Orleans Advocate, some patients at Thibodaux Regional Health System in La Fourche Parish, southwest of New Orleans, had to transport COVID-19 patients to a different floor due to a partial power outage. Staff had to ventilate patients by hand, pushing air in and out of their lungs through bags in lieu of mechanical ventilators. It was not clear how many patients had to be moved. Jerome Zeringa, a Louisiana state representative, said he had been in touch with a physician who reported that generators had failed in the intensive care unit and that conditions were Katrina-esque.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thousands of activists gathered nationwide to commemorate the 58th anniversary of Martin Luther King's Voting Equality March in Washington on Saturday. They protested against curbs to voting access in some Republican-led states that rights groups say disproportionately affect people of color. Many activists view the fight over voting rules as the civil rights issue of the era. In Washington, about 20,000 marchers held Black Lives Matter flags and signs and called on Congress to bolster voter rights. Other rallies were planned in Phoenix, Miami, and several other U.S. cities. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, a nonprofit public policy institute, for this year at least 18 states have adopted a total of 30 restrictive election laws, with dozens of others under consideration. Those laws range from a requirement to have a fixed address in order to register the vote to a ban on the drive-through voting that was popular in some states last year amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The organizers of Saturday's protests denounced the legislation as racist, anti-democratic voter suppression laws and demanded that the U.S. Congress pass legislation to block such voting restrictions. In July, U.S. President Joe Biden admitted that the recent push in Republican-controlled states to restrict voting access is in contrast with fair and free elections.
There's an unfolding assault taking place in America today, an attempt to suppress and subvert the right to vote in fair and free elections.
The Democratic-controlled House of Representatives has passed two draft laws to limit voting restrictions. But in the closely divided Senate, Republicans have promised to block voting rights legislation. This is a sign of polarization in the U.S. Congress.
Well, I think you have to look at it in the context of the United States political sphere. I don't think voting or our system in the United States is particularly democratic from the very onset. You have to keep in mind that when the United States Constitution was first written, first ratified, you know, only white male property owners were able to vote or have any say in public discourse. And unfortunately, not too much has changed. You know, maybe there's a little bit more people of color, maybe there's a little bit more women, but the property owning part is largely still in effect, because you have the average income of elected officials at the federal level is so high. I don't think most people in the United States feel represented by their elected officials. I don't think they think our country is going in the right direction.
American society is plagued with racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group, as they are twice as likely to die compared to their white counterparts. In addition, they are less likely to get vaccinated amid the variant spreads. On Saturday, thousands of people demonstrated in the U.S. Capitol, Washington, and in several cities across the country to demand voting rights protection.
Our country is backsliding to the unconscionable days of Jim Crow, and some of our senators are saying, well, we can't overcome the filibuster. Then I say to you today, get rid of the filibuster. That is the monument to slavery we must dismantle. That is the monument to white supremacy we must tear down.
I march because I'm tired of elected officials putting themselves first. To be honest, I am disgusted by the behavior of many of our leaders. In this country, it's easier to register to own a gun than it is to register to vote. Think about that. If you are a congressperson protecting firearms, why won't you protect the right to vote? That is completely unacceptable. I march because I want change, not just for me, but for everyone who comes next.
While some marchers carried posters supporting the end of the filibuster, others chanted about police violence toward black people, workers' rights, the Afghanistan withdrawal, and minimum wage. This is a clear message that voting rights were not the only issue in people's minds. A top Iranian official has condemned U.S. President Joe Biden for what he called illegally threatening the Islamic Republic. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, said Biden's emphasis on using other options with regard to Iran's nuclear program establishes Tehran's right to reciprocate. The reaction followed a meeting between the U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett at the White House. During the meeting, Biden said he was putting diplomacy first on Iran's nuclear issue, but added he would be prepared to turn to other options. By diplomacy, the U.S. president was pointing to the talks in Vienna, Austria, to reinstate the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, which was abandoned by former U.S. President Donald Trump in 2018. Biden also said he remains committed to ensuring that Iran never develops a nuclear weapon, while Iran has time and again rejected the accusation and stressed the fact that it seeks nuclear technology for peaceful purposes and not for developing weapons. Biden's threat of unspecific options came after Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, accused Iran of seeking a nuclear weapon. Gantz said military action should be considered as a plan B to prevent Tehran from accessing a nuclear warhead. That's while, unlike Iran, Israel is not a party to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, known as NPT. and is the only country in the region to have a nuclear arsenal.
Israel's possession of nuclear warheads poses a significant threat to regional stability.
The regime has carried a bombing campaign in Syria for the past years. It has threatened Iran militarily on numerous occasions and conducted sabotage attacks against the country. And when it comes to Hezbollah, Israel has repeatedly threatened to destroy the resistance group.
They can reach out and touch Iran anytime they feel like it. The question, of course, is what will Iran do if they are attacked? And that's what the Americans have to consider. And their Israeli masters.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said the current U.S. administration is not different from the former government of President Donald Trump, who abandoned an international nuclear deal and unleashed the most draconian sanctions on Iran. The leader also said, quote, "Behind the scenes of foreign policy, smile and self-righteous talk, America is a predatory wolf that sometimes turns into a cunning fox. An example is the current situation in Afghanistan." Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the U.S. has a nerve to behave in a way as if it was Iran which walked away from the nuclear deal. He also blasted France, Britain, and Germany for failing to live up to their commitments under the deal. The leader said the trio's obstructionism in implementing the accord is no less than that of the U.S. The leader made the remarks in a meeting with President Ebrahim Raisi and his newly formed cabinet on Saturday.
So we've got basically more of the same. We've got the Trump administration with a different face that supposedly is kindlier and friendlier, but is actually just as opposed to Iran being a self-sufficient country with a functioning economy that helps its people. This is what the United States and Israel don't want.
U.S. President Joe Biden has said that rejoining the nuclear agreement is one of his top foreign policy priorities. But he has been refusing to take any steps to bring Washington back to compliance with the accord. The Biden administration has shown an unusual urge to maintain key elements of sanctions imposed by his predecessor as leverage to pressure the Islamic Republic. On the other hand, Iran says since the U.S. unilaterally left the accord in 2018, it must first fulfill the obligation by removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner. That is, Iran is able to see the effect of the removal of sanctions in practice.
On Thursday, the Afghan capital Kabul became the scene of carnage. Scores of people were killed after two bombs exploded in the crowd outside the international Kabul airport. The Pentagon, however, stated there was only one bomb attack. Over a dozen U.S. troops were confirmed to have been killed in the attack. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility. The blast came as hundreds of people were rushing to leave the Afghan capital prior to the August 31st deadline set by U.S. President Joe Biden to fully withdraw troops from the country. Intelligence reports had warned about the possibility of attacks on the airport by an offshoot of the Daesh terrorist group, which has fought against both foreign forces and the Taliban in Afghanistan since its formation in 2015. The U.S. president vowed revenge on the perpetrators, saying the evacuation efforts will continue regardless.
To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this. We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Some, however, are questioning why the U.S. chose to withdraw from this Central Asian country at this point, and if it can continue its operations in Afghanistan without having a military base there.
I think that there are a couple of reasons. First of all, they might not have thought it was important. Secondly, they were probably preoccupied with getting out. Thirdly, I'm not sure that their intelligence is as good as they say. And I think that from their point of view, they had degraded Al-Qaeda to the point that they were satisfied with. They were not focused on Afghanistan.
The outcome of the United States' longest war has also raised questions about the success of foreign military presence in the country. More than 111,000 people have been flown out of Afghanistan since the Taliban swept to power on August 15th. The Taliban had allowed U.S.-led forces to conduct the airlift while planning to finalize their own government as soon as the American troops left. U.S. forces are racing to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by an August 31st deadline set by President Biden. His administration is facing growing criticism over the situation in Afghanistan and what is seen as a hasty withdrawal after two decades of military presence. Biden, however, says the U.S. has long ago achieved its original rationale for invading Afghanistan in 2001, to root out the Al-Qaeda militants and prevent a repeat of the September 11 attacks on the United States. He has noted that the aim of the war has never been nation-building, a statement in contrast to what U.S. officials used to say when the war began.
But the fundamental issue is that in many, many cases, it's not only Afghanistan, it's been Syria, it's been Iraq, it has been countries in Africa. We've intervened in South America. Basically, without any willingness on the United States' part to recognize the sovereignty of other countries. So unless we begin to deal with that, I don't think we're going to be particularly effective in dealing with groups that we conceive to be terrorists.
Over the past 20 years, the U.S. and its NATO allies maintained a military presence in Afghanistan with the stated aim of fighting terrorists. The recent incident at the Kabul airport was a clear indication that the mission was not accomplished.
The U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has arrived in Vietnam as she continues a tour of Southeast Asia in an attempt to co-opt countries against China. Speaking in Hanoi on Wednesday, Harris said that there was a need to increase pressure on Beijing over its maritime claims in the South China Sea. She offered Vietnamese President's support to counter Beijing in the South China Sea. We need to find ways to pressure, raise the pressure on Beijing, to abide by the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and to challenge its bullying and excessive maritime claims. Speaking in Singapore one day earlier, Harris had said that Beijing's use of what she called scare tactics in the South China Sea continued to undermine what she described as a rules-based order and threatened the sovereignty of other regional nations. Laying out the U.S. administration's foreign policy goals, Harris reiterated that Washington had enduring interests in the Indo-Pacific region and aimed to counter Beijing's aggressive advances, as well as to maintain freedom of navigation. Harris sought to assure America's Southeast Asian allies that growing U.S.-China tensions would not force nations that have strong ties with both countries to choose one side of the political equation. She said, however, that Washington would take the side of its allies in all of their territorial disputes with China.
Our vision includes freedom of navigation, which is vital to us all. The livelihood of millions of people depend on the billions of dollars in trade that flow through these sea lanes each day. And yet, in the South China Sea, we know that Beijing continues to coerce, to intimidate, and to make claims to the vast majority of the South China Sea.
Well, we know that the United States has little to no regard for international law and regulations. As a matter of fact, a couple months ago, there was an article published about the United States Coast Guard being in the, I believe it was Mediterranean. Now, mind you, why would the Coast Guard of the United States be in international waters unless the United States has no desire to keep international regulations and to follow international procedure?
In response to Harris's remarks, Chinese state media decried the U.S. vice president, accusing her of interfering in regional affairs by seeking to divide China and Southeast Asian nations to prevent Beijing's economic growth. China's state-run China Daily said in an editorial that while pointing a finger at China and accusing it of coercion and intimidation, Harris willfully ignored her own hypocrisy in attempting to coerce and intimidate regional countries to join Washington in a scheme to contain China. Seems that the United States' only commitment to Southeast Asia is its dedicated efforts to drive a wedge between the Southeast Asian nations and China. Meanwhile, China has accused Washington of bullying and hegemonic behavior. China's foreign ministry said that Afghanistan was one of the many examples defining what the U.S.'s so-called world order truly meant for nations.
The U.S. can come and go as it wishes and doesn't need to seek the international community's opinions, not even those of its allies. In order to defend America first, the U.S. can arbitrarily smear, suppress, coerce, and bully other countries and without paying any price. This is the order the U.S. wants.
The U.S. sees its rivalry with China as the biggest geopolitical test of the century. Southeast Asia has seen a series of high-profile visits by top U.S. administration officials, including the Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who visited Hanoi in late July. The visits have escalated tensions between the U.S. and China, which were already high due to a range of issues ranging from cybersecurity to human rights abuses.
The United States wants to destabilize China. China is an upcoming economic superpower. Its economy in some places has already surpassed the United States. China has a growing, the most large population in the world. It is sitting on trillions and trillions of dollars worth of important resources for modern technology. It's beginning to take a lead in the space race.
The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes, through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year and contains huge gas fields and rich fishing grounds. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway and since 2014 has built artificial islands and reefs and installed military bases on them.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
For two decades, Americans have told each other one lie after another about the war in Afghanistan. The lies have come from the White House, Congress, the State Department, the Pentagon, and the CIA, as well as from Hollywood, cable news pundits, journalists, and the broader culture, says James Risen, writer, in an article titled, For two decades, Americans told one lie after another about what they were doing in Afghanistan. Stay tuned, please, for the first part of this article. For two decades, Americans have told each other one lie after another about the war in Afghanistan. The lies have come from the White House, Congress, the State Department, the Pentagon, and the CIA, as well as from Hollywood, cable news pundits, journalists, and the broader culture. Americans have hungered for a simple storyline, with heroes and villains, to make sense of the longest war in the United States history. They have wanted stories like 12 Strong to make them feel good. But at the very edge of the American empire, the war was nasty and brutish and brought out in Americans the same imperial arrogance that doomed the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. This month, as the Taliban swiftly take control of Kabul and the American-backed government collapse, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, the government's watchdog over the Afghan experience, issued his final report.
The assessment includes remarkably candid interviews with former American officials involved in shaping U.S. policy in Afghanistan that collectively offer perhaps the most biting critique of the 20-year American enterprise ever published in an official U.S. government report. The extraordinary costs were meant to serve a purpose, the report notes, though the definition of that purpose evolved over time. Released in the days after Kabul fell, the report reads like an epitaph for America's involvement in Afghanistan. One of the first things the U.S. did after gaining effective control over Afghanistan following the Taliban's ouster in 2001 was to set up secret torture chambers. Beginning in 2002, the CIA tortured both Afghans and foreign prisoners flown to these torture rooms from all over Central Asia, Africa, the West Asia, North Africa region. The worst torture chamber was nicknamed the Darkness by the prisoners sent there, who suffered such complete sensory deprivation that they did not even know they were in Afghanistan. They were chained in solitary confinement with no light and music blaring constantly. They were hung by their arms for as long as 2 days, slammed against walls, forced to lie naked on traps, while gallons of ice water were poured over their bodies. At least one prisoner died in CIA custody after being left shackled in frigid temperatures. No one was ever held to account for the American torture regime in Afghanistan. American drone strikes also started early in Afghanistan. The CIA killed Al-Qaeda operative Mohammad Atef and others with a drone there in November 2001, just 2 months after 9/11. Afghanistan soon became the beta test site for high-tech drone warfare, leading to countless civilian casualties and deep resentment among the Afghan people, who felt helpless against the unseen threats circling overhead. America's early adoption of drone warfare in Afghanistan helped make a fortune for Neil Blue, the chair of General Atomics. The Southern California Energy and Defense Corporation manufactured the Predator, the first armed drone to fly over Afghanistan. General Atomics subsequently produced the Predator's follow-on model, the Reaper. Blue and his brother, Lyndon Blue, vice chair of General Atomics, maintained low public profiles throughout the war. But as owners of privately held General Atomics, they were among the first but hardly the last American contractors to enrich themselves as blood spilled in Afghanistan. Before long, the CIA's drone campaign shifted from going after the few Al-Qaeda operatives it could find in Afghanistan to targeting the Taliban, thus placing the drone campaign squarely in the midst of Afghan domestic insurgency. The U.S. launched more than 13,000 drone strikes in Afghanistan between 2015 and 2020, killing up to 10,000 people, according to statistics kept by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. The CIA, relying on cell phone numbers to find, fix, and finish its alleged enemies, often launched its Hellfire missiles at the wrong targets or at targets standing amid groups of civilians. The practice devastated Afghan villages. Yet the United States regime refused to keep track of civilian casualties from drone strikes. Instead, officials insisted that each strike had hit its intended target, while ignoring the claims of villagers that the missiles had killed a